The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight with Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
All right, welcome to a Friday. Oh, it's Friday. Thank goodness for Fridays. I'm going to point out something right here at the start of the show that I'll probably mention again at least one more time during the show, but it's important to me, and it should be important to you. Tomorrow, Saturday, August 17th, is the National Clear the Shelters Day. In case you hadn't heard me talk about it before, I volunteer every week at the I live in Broward County, Florida, Fort Lauderdale, basically. I volunteer at the Broward County Animal Care and Adoption Center. And yes, that's where I adopted Jackson from 5 years ago. They've moved to a nicer facility since. But I volunteer there usually every Sunday, helping with the dogs, walking them, playing with them, giving them a little bit of love because they need it and they want it so badly, and helping them get adopted. Well, tomorrow, our shelter is participating with about 300 others around the country in the National Clear the Shelters Day. If you're even thinking about adopting a pet, cats, dogs, they've got them all, stop by a shelter tomorrow. There's all kinds of cool giveaways and incentives, and hopefully you'll meet your new best friend. So if you're in South Florida, come on down to the Broward County shelter. I'll be there really all day tomorrow, and let me help you find the dog of your dreams. Okay? All right. Now, I usually begin the show, as you regulars know, with a bit of comedy. That's because I try to point out that we've got to find pleasurable means of distraction from the reality that is what Trump is doing to the nation and the planet. So we usually turn to laughter. But today's a little different because 50 years ago today, or 50 years ago yesterday, I guess more accurately, I got to interrupt because Chris Dirks in the chat room said, fifth annual Clear the Shelters, adopt for only $20. I don't know what it's like in Los Angeles, but here all adoption fees are waived for the Clear the Shelters Day, and they're supposed to be around the country. So I have a feeling all adoption fees are waived everywhere everywhere that's participating in Clear the Shelter Day. Okay, had to get that out there. Anyway, so again, 50 years ago yesterday, really, throngs of people, about 500,000 strong, descended on the tiny town of Bethel, New York, to a farm owned by a man named Max Yasgur for 3 days of peace and music. Doesn't that sound great? And today also, sort of a non sequitur, happens to be the anniversary of the passing of Elvis Presley in 1977. And if time permits, I have a story about hearing that news when it happened. But today is a good day to consider the healing properties of music. Woodstock, you know, I vacillate. It may not have changed things in the world, but in another sense, it changed everything. Everything. I know that 50 years later, 3 days of peace and music is just what the doctor ordered. But is it possible to recreate it? Probably not. They tried it like in 94 and 99, and they were just, you know, it's sort of embarrassing to use the name Woodstock associated with it. And plans for a 50th anniversary of Woodstock were fraught with problems, and the idea just fizzled out. So, but Woodstock, the summer of 1969, was a time when most of the people who made the trek to Woodstock were faced with the reality of the Vietnam War. Either their own draft number was coming up or it was for someone close to them. Right? We had just gone through 1968 and the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. But in this tiny enclave in upstate New York for 3 days, it was peace and music, brown acid, and lots of rain. Right? Well, the Associated Press put together a short featurette, as it were, on Woodstock that I thought would be a good thing to kick off today's show. So instead of a bit of comedy, we'll do a bit of, you know, peace and music and memories. As usual, for those listening to the audio version only, I'll read any text that appears on the screen. All right. So with no further ado, today's diversion from the seriousness of the situation comes by way of music and Woodstock.
We had assassinations. We had riots. We had birth control pill. We had the anti-war movement. We had the civil rights movement. Yep. It just was a soup that was about to boil over.
In the summer of 1969, it says on the screen, Rona Elliott worked on the production team that mounted an unprecedented music festival northwest of New York City. 50 years later, Elliott and others reflect on the lessons of Woodstock.
Perhaps the year's most incredible event was the Woodstock Music and Art Festival in New York's Catskill Mountains in late August. It was a gathering of the hippie element with leading rock performers, the advertised attractions. Promoters rented land from a dairy farmer and made plans for a turnout of 120,000 for the three-day event. But 400,000 of the now generation turned up. They came by car, truck, bus, and hitchhiker's thumb. When traffic became hopelessly tangled, they traveled on foot. Torrential rains turned the area into a swampland. There was a shortage of food and sanitary facilities, and no shelter except for makeshift tents. Most could not get close enough to the stage to hear the performers, and the size of the throng made it impossible for the promoters to police the gate. Drugs were so prevalent that one youngster said you could get high just by breathing.
Ooh, yeah.
Despite all the hardships, despite all the potentials for violence, one police official said he had never seen so many people in so small an area act so peacefully. What did it all mean? Was it revolution or a picnic? Sociologists are still pondering.
A lesson, if there is one to take from that, is you can't plan euphoria. Things tend to happen spontaneously. You can only just be open to that.
Everything today is organized down to the last detail.
True.
When you go to a show, you've got your parking pass, you've got your VIP access, you've got your bathroom access, you've got the stamp on your hand, you pass through 7 lines of security. None of that happened at Woodstock. It was spontaneous, and it was loving, and it was community. So what happens now, and it's to take nothing away from it, it just isn't Woodstock.
Just isn't Woodstock. And that, from the Associated Press, the lessons from Woodstock, a 6-minute piece. I thought it was interesting. And I enjoyed actually reading both chat rooms. We've got 2 chat rooms going during the live show, one on YouTube and one in NicoleSandler.com. And I loved reading the comments. Some of us were, you know, alive, but like me, too young to appreciate it. I was born in November of 59, so I was 9 years old on this date in 1969. I lived in New York at the time. I think my babysitter, Melanie, might have gone, but I also think she went to see the Beatles at Shea Stadium. So I may have just made up those memories and projected them on her. I don't know. But again, this is a great weekend to go watch the movie Woodstock. Because someone in the chat room said, wow, Santana was at Woodstock? Hell yeah. There were a lot of great people at Woodstock. And a lot of the performances have been sort of deified. But it's a fascinating, especially if you've never seen the documentary on Woodstock, watch it. first of all, great music, but just seeing the social construct, just seeing the ecosystem that sprung up from the multitudes of hippies, and the rain and the brown acid and everything else. It's an experience you can live through vicariously. Anyway, and I mentioned at the top that this today is also the anniversary of when Elvis Presley died in 1977. In 1977, I was just, I guess I was home from college. No, I was getting ready to go away to college. I graduated from high school in 77, but I didn't go to my senior year of high school. Instead, I went to Broward, then Community College, now Broward College, and got my freshman, all of my freshman requirements out of the way while I was still technically a senior in high school because I only had electives left. So, and I smoked a lot of pot. I grew up in South Florida, and in the 70s, there was a lot of marijuana here. You heard Robert Platshorn the other day, who was arrested for smuggling weed into South Florida. This is where it all came in. So we had, and it wasn't the kind of stuff you get today, which is overpriced and through the dispensary. It was Colombian gold buds, Panama red buds, Jamaican dirt weed, Mexican dirt weed. What about the PBS special on Woodstock? I don't even know about the PBS special. We watched it? Okay, there's an awesome PBS special on Woodstock. I'm on to something else now. Sorry. Now I lost my train of thought. I know he means well. There's a PBS special on Woodstock. Go find it. I was talking about the different strains of pot that we got back there. So they didn't have names like, Girl Scout Cookie or Orange Kush or anything like that. It was Colombian Gold, Panama Red, Mexican, Jamaican Dirt Weed, stuff like that. I was out that afternoon. The school year had ended, so I'd already graduated. I guess I was getting ready to go away to the University of South Florida, like any minute now, because school started right around this time of year, right? And I must have been out with my friends getting high, and I came home, and we had a radio in the kitchen, like an intercom that ran through the whole house. This was the 70s, And the radio was on, and the news broke that Elvis Presley died. And my mother looked at me, and my mother said, "Wow, did you hear that? Elvis died." And I started laughing and laughing and giggling uncontrollably. It was the weed. It was obviously giggly pot, but I couldn't stop laughing. Now, I was not a big Elvis Presley fan, never was. I'm more of an Elvis Costello person. There are a few Elvis songs I like, but again, he was before my time, and I never got Elvis. Just I wasn't there. And for some reason, the idea of him dying, and we didn't even know that he had died on his toilet until later, but I broke into an uncontrollable fit of laughter that I couldn't shake, and I couldn't explain to my mother why I was laughing. So there's my story of Elvis Presley dying. It wasn't much of one, but it is a memory. Anyway, so here we are today. I got to tell you, I'm glad that I'm able to lighten up a little bit because I'm really upset over this nonsense. What's going on with Israel and Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar? First, Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib were denied an entry visa to visit Israel with a congressional delegation because they support the BDS movement. We need to do a show on BDS because, frankly, from what I know of it, I support it. And to be really honest, I try to stay out of a lot of this because it's a no-win situation. I was contacted on Twitter a few years ago by somebody who was a childhood friend of mine. We went to dancing school together when we were, 8, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. And in fact, we even went to summer sleepaway camp one year. And I was in her bunk. She was a year older than me, so they made a big concession to allow me in her bunk. Anyway, turns out that this woman, whose Twitter handle is Shari, Hold on. Shari something, her, whatever. It doesn't matter. She's basically a Zionist. Look, I grew up in a Jewish household too, but not religious. And I've made it very clear what my stance is. And in case I need to clarify it, I believe in Israel's right to exist. I believe based on the history of the persecution of the Jews in this world, Israel is a necessity for the existence of the Jewish people. It's a sad fact. However, the current government of Israel are hateful, bigoted, I was going to say Nazis, and that might be taking it a bit too far, but not very much too far. I believe what Netanyahu and his cabal of war criminals are doing is treating the Palestinians who are imprisoned in the Gaza Strip almost as badly as our Jewish ancestors were treated by the Germans. Now, as far as I know, there are no gas chambers and they're not being exterminated, but they are being held in an open-air prison. Their lands are being occupied. They're being forced out of their homes, and they're being told what they can and can't have. There are no supplies allowed into Gaza because it's blocked on all three sides that there's land and blocked by a water on the other side. Israel does not allow them the basic human necessities to live their lives. Now, some say, you know, that, oh my God, they're lobbing bombs. It's a red alert in Israel. Yeah, those Palestinians in Gaza who have access to so many resources against one of the world's superpowers, a nuclear power, there's no contest there. And it's like, Goliath raining down on David. It's unfair. It's unconscionable. It's inhumane. And I'm ashamed that Netanyahu is associated with my people in any way, shape, or form. Do I believe Israel has a right to exist? Damn straight I do. Do I think they have a right to what they're doing, to the way they're treating other human beings? Fuck no. And for them to tell Rashida Tlaib she wasn't welcome there, but that she could come in to see her grandmother, as long as she didn't speak out or say anything critical of, Egypt blocks them too. That's right. Gaza is blocked on all sides. Egypt is one of those sides. I'm not saying anybody's blameless here. They're all to blame. The Palestinians are to blame for following Hamas. Shame on them. The Israelis are to blame for following this right-wing Zionist approach. You think you're better than other people? You're not. I did save, hold on, where is it? Rashida Tlaib wrote, she explained why she then turned down their concession to allow her in to see her grandmother. And what she said was, I have decided not to travel to Palestine and Israel at this time. Visiting my grandmother under these oppressive conditions meant to humiliate me would break my grandmother's heart. Silencing me with treatment to make me feel less than is not what she wants for me. It would kill a piece of me that always stands up against racism and injustice. And I can't say I blame her, but how shameful it is that she can't see her grandmother, and she may never have the opportunity to see her again. So I got into this former friend on Twitter starts adding me with, red alert, Israel under fire from, and she sent me something in, written in Hebrew. Sorry, I don't read Hebrew. I read English. I'm American. But basically, to make a long story short, I blocked her because she turned out to be a hateful Zionist who doesn't understand that she's preaching the same hatred that has been lobbed at Jews for centuries. Shame on her. Shame on her. All right. I've got what's news. We'll save that till after because I have an interview. Totally changing subject here. I told you we were going to get serious again. But we hopefully we'll get back to the music before the end of the show. I have a song to share to take us into the weekend, I hope, if we have time. So let's make time. But yesterday, I read an article up at the American Prospect that I realized everybody needs to read. It's entitled, Have Democrats Forgotten How to Do Oversight? Now, if you're a regular listener of the show, you know that this is one of my pet peeves, as it were. I think of the Democrats today as completely feckless. I mean, I'm glad Gerald Nadler is making the noises that he is, saying we are in an impeachment inquiry, but I still see a Congress on recess and nothing happening. So when I saw this article, David Dayan, who's now the editor of the American Prospect, tweeted it out, and I immediately emailed him and asked him to put me in touch with the journalist, Jim Lardner, to get him on for an interview, and here we are. Joining me on the line is Jim Lardner. He's a journalist and an activist who has a must-read piece up right now at the American Prospect, which you can get to at prospect.org, or you can get the hard magazine as well. It's always a good issue. This piece is entitled, Have Democrats Forgotten How to Do Oversight? And I got to tell you, the headline caught my attention immediately, and my cynical mind replied, did they ever know how to do oversight? I mean, the last time Nancy Pelosi had the chance as Speaker of the House to hold a criminal president accountable for his actions, she did nothing about, say, George W. Bush's lying us into a war that's still going on. So, Jim, can we start there? Were Democrats ever capable of oversight?
There have been hearings and investigations within our lifetimes that have had some real impact. Okay. They don't happen that often. That's not always predictable. If you think back, I guess the ones that come to mind would be the Watergate hearings, obviously.
Right.
Maybe Iran-Contra. I mentioned in my article the hearings in 1994 when some number of tobacco company executives were all asked if they thought nicotine was addictive, and one after another they claimed to believe that it wasn't addictive,
right.
Despite the fact that by that time the committee before which they were testifying had mobilized evidence that their companies had longstanding knowledge of the addictive properties of nicotine and had even taken advantage of it, taken commercial advantage of those properties. You know, that's memorable. And the Democrats have practiced oversight, I guess, with sometimes in a timid way, but also when they've done it, they've been a little more responsible than the Republican Party, to say the least. You know, what passed for oversight over the last recent years was, you know, like the Benghazi hearings, which were just endless vituperation and repeating of lies. And so they've kind of lost, you might say, the muscle has not been exercised much recently, the oversight muscle.
Right. So obviously, I think this article is a very important, timely, topical piece that I hope some people in power will pay attention to. So basically, what you did was you reached out to a range of experts on congressional oversight to determine their thoughts on how the Democrats should and shouldn't go about this. Is that the premise of the piece?
Well, that's right. And let me just start one step before that.
Okay.
We have the crookedest, lyingest president in our history,
yep.
And we have an administration that is riddled with corruption and deals and favors and self-enrichment. And up until recently, the investigation of all that was, you know, willy-nilly was the Mueller investigation, which was focused on this one thing, Russia and election interference. And since the Mueller report was delivered and the hope of a sort of, you know, of a conspiracy of that kind that would lead to immediate a scandal that the Democrats wouldn't have to put their fingerprints on, was since that they didn't come away with that, they've just sort of fallen asleep in terms of the whole process of continuing to expose and illuminate the administration and its hench people. And that's what I think that they should be using oversight for, that purpose. And I did go out and talk to people who have been good at this in the past, and I found that they were pretty much agreed that the task is to just hammer away, to investigate one area after another, because there are, in fact, so many areas, and to expose both what we already know and unearth what we don't yet know. Because, you know, this, we've never had someone with so much to hide in such a visible place. And if people keep on looking, they're going to find stuff. And corruption has been the undoing of leaders around the world and in the past, and could and rightly should be the undoing of this one. So, but, you know, the House Democrats have just not risen to the challenge. It's
right.
Kind of a long game, I guess, and they're preoccupied. They've been preoccupied with other things.
Right.
Let us hope they are now about to take on this task.
Well, I would hope so. Are you as surprised and perhaps perturbed as I am that Congress is on recess? I mean, I don't understand. I know that Gerald Nadler says he's calling the Judiciary Committee back into session to deal with guns. Why did they ever leave? Why haven't they been working through this so-called recess? Because I think we've got something more important than, frankly, the vacation of the members of Congress.
Well, this stuff calls for patience, and you don't know for sure what you're going to find, what is going to have impact, how fast it's going to develop. That, I think, is the test or the challenge for them. They have to recognize that, and the history of oversight does tell us that sometimes if you just keep pounding away at something, Benghazi business,
yeah,
and for that matter, the emails were largely concocted scandals, but the Republicans pounded away at them, and they, in fact, scored a lot of points. We're talking about real scandals that, unfortunately, you know, Americans may be inured to. If the Democrats stop exposing them and talking about them, they're playing into the hands of the administration and the Republicans who want to normalize themselves.
Well, exactly. And we're speaking with journalist Jim Lardner, who's got a great piece up in the American Prospect at prospect.org on oversights. Have Democrats forgotten how to do oversight? And so you as I said, you spoke with a lot of individuals who are currently or formerly involved in the congressional oversight process and got their take. One word of advice you got is, I guess, overwhelming advice. People said, don't just continue Mueller's case. The House must define investigations broadly as inquiry into, I love this, kleptocratic corruption of self-enrichment, crony enrichment, and betrayal of the public trust. Obviously, it's bigger than the very narrow scope of the Mueller inquiry. And so here we are, and you would think, I mean, they're telling us that this impeachment inquiry, as it were, is in full swing, but we're not seeing these daily hearings. We're not hearing the stories. And I love you go through and you mention in the piece some of the members of Congress that you've spoken to. For instance, you talk about Jamie Raskin, of whom I'm a big fan. And Jamie Raskin stressed to you the need for good storytelling, something that the Democrats don't seem to be grasping at this point, do they?
Absolutely. The hearings that have packed a lot of punch have told good stories.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell good stories. You can explain to people who oligarchs and thugs are that the Trump organization has apparently been in cahoots with or getting financing from for years.
Mm-hmm.
You can talk about how the Department of Education, when it's run by for-profit college pirates and lenders or riddled with them, does not enforce a public interest student loan forbearance program. We have tens of thousands of people with heavy student loan debt who are working as nurses and firefighters and teachers and are supposed to have their loans forgiven and can't get any action from education. And you could have those people testify, and then you could bring in some of the officials in the government who would like to be doing their jobs but are not allowed to do their jobs because they're working for conflicted or corrupt superiors. And if they're unwilling to testify publicly, well, they can wear hoods over their faces, or actors can be hired to read their testimony. That would be kind of dramatic. Mm-hmm. You know, the Trump administration won't let its own people testify unless, you know, court action nails them. So you have to go be creative and look for right. other witnesses. Okay. You have to look for the people at Deutsche Bank who tried yes. to blow the whistle on their own bank for lending money to the Trump crowd and Jared Kushner after they had had walked away from debts and were clearly irresponsible.
Yeah, but you said something very telling there, Jim. You said the president won't allow the staffers to testify. And it's not only his staffers. I mean, he's telling people who previously worked in the administration or previously worked on the campaign or perhaps was just an informal advisor. It doesn't matter what their role was. It seems like if they've ever had a conversation with Donald Trump, Donald Trump and his attorney general, by the way, are telling them, don't worry, you can ignore congressional subpoenas. Now, obviously, that's not legal. What recourse does Congress have in their responsibility of doing oversight to compel these people to comply with the subpoenas?
They go to court, you know?
Yeah.
And my complaint is that they're just spending too much time telling us about their court cases
right.
and the rights and wrongs of the administration's responsibility to come before Congress and so forth, instead of looking for a way to illuminate these issues of corruption one after another as best they can with, you know, people, witnesses and materials and evidence that they can secure. You know, they could do an investigation. The House Oversight Committee could have an investigation of multiple agencies with corporate lobbyists and corporate executives in key roles that are therefore incapable of doing their normal duties. You've got a fossil fuel lobbyist as an interior secretary.
Yep.
You've got a former airline person running the FAA, a former Goldman Sachs lawyer running the SEC. You could put up an electronic map and have one agency of government after another light up when you point out its corrupt or conflicted leader or
right.
Key decision maker.
And Jim, we could go
the Trump hotels
yeah.
and resorts, all the foreign dignitaries and business promoters who have trooped through there paying heaps of money into the Trump coffers on their way to meetings with Trump-appointed public officials.
You can go on like this for literally hours. The list never ends of all the norms he's busted, all the rules he's breaking, all the laws he's ignoring and thumbing his nose at. So the question remains, what the fuck are the Democrats doing? Why are we still sitting here saying, well, now there's 127 House Democrats who have called for an impeachment inquiry? Why? I mean, why? To me and to many of us who went, you know, balls to the wall to get Democrats elected in 2018 for oversight reasons, why they are seemingly sitting and twiddling their thumbs?
Well, we know that there is some fear about seeming confrontational. Oh. And on this single question of impeachment, they're looking at polls that say that they don't have majority support for impeachment and that some of those voters that they need to win over are wary of impeachment. And, you know, there's that fear. I think that they need to, with as far as oversight and having hearings go, they've got to overcome that timidity and just get on with it and do it right, do it seriously without grandstanding and posturing. Just as you said, they could have hearings from now until Election Day 2020 nonstop because there are so many issues. They could and they should. and they should just, you know, be patient and hope and expect that the cumulative effect of all of that will be profound.
I would hope. They got to get started on it. You know, we remember from Watergate, those of us who are old enough, that when the hearings began, I believe the public sentiment was not at all in favor of impeachment. I think the level for impeachment was like 17% approval or something at the beginning of it. And once people started seeing these hearings on television every day and hearing what was actually happening, those numbers moved very quickly. Is Nancy Pelosi just too much of a political creature to look at this realistically?
You know, there is one key difference, which is that the Republican Party in Congress in the 1970s was not completely beholden to and corrupted by the president and
anybody,
big money and corporate backers the way today's Republican Party is. So it is probably true that the dream of getting moderate Republicans to care about the crimes of Donald Trump, to publicly care and support impeachment, is a fantasy.
Right. But to worry that, you know, to suppose what the electorate will do in the wake of an impeachment, especially when it's a president so richly deserving of one, isn't that a bit presumptuous on Nancy Pelosi's part? I mean, we don't have a clear indication. There are those who argue that Bill Clinton's impeachment helped the Democrats, but there are those who say, no, it helped the Republicans. You know, maybe it didn't do anything. Maybe people just want the truth to come out.
Well, you know, so the Republicans won the congressional election. The Democrats won the congressional election.
Yeah.
Presidency, so that was kind of a wash. I think your point about people are swayable.
Mm-hmm.
It is a myth that Americans are numbed or simply don't care about the crimes of Donald Trump. In the 2018 election, voters cited corruption as the second biggest issue on their minds, next to the economy. A lot of people who have supported Donald Trump, some of those people who voted for Barack and incredibly proceeded to vote for Donald Trump, say, you know, well, the corruption and the criminality worries them. But what I'm trying to say is that the story is only half known. And it's out of sight because so much else has taken priority in the news cycle and in Congress. They need to get on with the business of investigating Trump corruption and to do it with patience and nonstop.
Right. And not worry. You know, not trying to guess what the outcome is going to be. Let the process play out. I mean, and one thing that I think your article points out pretty well, Jim Lardner, that a lot of people don't get. Impeachment is the process that happens in the House. It's the hearings. It's the public spectacle of it. It's getting all the facts out in the open. A president who has gone through this process has been impeached. Then it goes to the Senate to be judged to see if the Senate will convict and remove the president from office. Even if they don't, he's still been impeached, right?
Yes, and you know, Nancy Pelosi has actually herself said that the task is one of educating the public,
exactly,
and going on to investigate, and that's really what counts here, probably not the outcome of the official impeachment process, the House Judiciary Committee has now said we are conducting an impeachment inquiry, and thank goodness they've said it.
No kidding.
And the but the upshot of it, I think, will be determined how much information that committee and also the Intelligence Committee and the Oversight Committee and the Financial Services Committee, all of which have large tasks on their hands, separate challenges of investigation, and possibly some of those other committees actually will be better equipped to get at the real dirt than committee.
Right. And the dangers, one last question for you, the dangers of the Democrats not fulfilling their constitutional obligation to conduct oversight of this administration. What are the consequences if they don't do it and do it adequately?
I think we've seen it since the end of the Mueller investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Is that America's attention shifts away from the crookedness and corruption and maladministration of a historically unprecedented kind of this administration, not just the administration, of its of the Republicans in Congress as well. And we've wrapped up in the latest Trump tweet, or simply in North Korea, or whatever other issue Trump concocts or emergency that Trump concocts to cover up the real ongoing emergency of his self-enrichment and a demagoguery and autocratic dreams.
Right. And of course, not only Donald Trump, but whatever presidents come after him, if there are any, you know, this sets a whole new precedent that is dangerous. And obviously not one we want to experience. So Congress needs to do its duty as outlined in Article 1 of the Constitution and provide oversight. And in this article at the American Prospect at prospect.org, Jim Lordner lays out not only why the Democrats need to do this, but how they should go about it, and a litany of areas that are ripe for investigation, for hearings. I would like to see it. You talk about patience. I don't think we have time for much patience. I think Congress needs to come back and they need to get started in earnest. Rather than just telling us that the impeachment inquiry has begun, I want to see it. I want those hearings started on my television every day now. Do you think we'll be seeing that come fall?
That's exactly what I want to see, too. And the patience I'm talking about is a different kind of patience.
Okay.
It's the willingness to do it.
Yeah.
From this fall through the winter and the spring,
yeah,
and the summer of 2020 nonstop, and to go to multiple areas where we have already evidence of horrible corruption and suspicions of more, and have the patience to keep at it without knowing exactly when or how it's going to bear fruit in the form of your rage and alarm.
Gotcha. Jim Lordner, thank you so much. Thank you for writing this article, because it needed to be written. It is at in the American Prospect at prospect.org. I'll put a link on my blog along with today's podcast. I'll put it in the comments section or the description of the YouTube video of today's show. I want people to read it, so please then go out and share it. Jim Lordner, it was a pleasure to meet you. Thank you very much for writing it, and thanks for joining us today. Talk about it.
Thank you.
All right. Oh, and there you go, Jim Lordner from the American Prospect. And yes, I will make sure to post the link at all those places I just said. We've got a few minutes left, so let me. I want to do a sort of a postscript on a story we talked about yesterday. I opened the show yesterday with the story of what happened to a group of protesters, Jewish American protesters from a group called Never Again Action, who are protesting these migrant detention facilities, or concentration camps, whatever you want to call them, all over the country, and the treatment of these migrants. And what happened was so disturbing. They were at a facility, the Wyatt Detention Center in Rhode Island, peacefully protesting outside the facility. And if you're watching on YouTube, I'm going to play for you the video, the raw video of a truck, a pickup truck, being driven by one of the guards at the facility right into this line of protesters who, again, were sitting there obeying the law, peacefully protesting. And this is what happened. All right, so you see them. Right? It's a typical protest. They're doing their thing. Lots of people out there.
You say now. Justice.
Now.
Justice.
Now.
When I say release, you say kids. Release the
kids.
Yeah.
When I say release, you say parents.
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 Okay. So now the people are just standing around doing their thing, right? And up runs a truck, pulls up right to the line of people sitting on the sidewalk. And the protesters start banging on the truck, and he drives right through them over some people. This is what happened 2 days ago in Rhode Island. Okay? So the whole world is watching. Then, hold on, let me bring this back. Then the guards, or you know, I guess workers at the facility come out and they surround the truck to protect the driver, and they start pepper spraying the protesters. Pepper spraying the protesters. Five of those protesters were taken to the hospital. One 74-year-old woman, a 65-year-old man had his leg broken. There were a lot of injuries. And so then, I was dismayed last night watching the news. I don't think I saw any coverage at all. And no, it wasn't a crazy drunk driver. It was a guard from that private for-profit prison where they're keeping these migrants, most of whom I believe came here seeking asylum. But to make matters worse, okay, that's frightening and disgusting. And I was really dismayed at the lack of any coverage in the mainstream media yesterday. I saw nothing on any of those MSNBC shows, nothing anywhere. Granted, I didn't watch them nonstop, but I saw no coverage on the nightly news, nothing. You know who covered it? Lou Dobbs, that hateful piece of shit. And you know what Lou Dobbs said? I can't paraphrase it. I'm going to play it for you.
In Rhode Island, harassing a federal detention center worker last night.
Harassing a worker.
These demonstrators blocking the entrance to a facility holding illegal immigrants when the driver
tried to pull in.
They were blocking
the entrance. Oh.
To the parking lot, the protesters surrounded him.
Oh, is that what happened?
Banging on the hood of the truck, blocking his entrance into the facility. In jurisdictions all around the country,
oh,
by the way, what
God.
They committed is assault. Trying to stop and block a vehicle is considered assault. In some instances, banging on an occupied vehicle is considered assault.
Are you fucking me? I'm sorry. Lou Dot, the driver who was a guard at the prison, who was wearing his badge, he was identified. They know who he is. There's no question as to who this driver was. A guard at this Wyatt Detention Center drove his truck into a row of protesters sitting peacefully on the sidewalk. And Lou Dobbs said they assaulted him. This, my friends, is opposite world. This is disgusting. And for whatever reason, the officer is on paid administrative leave. He's still not even, hasn't even been arrested. So I spent a good part of the morning trying to call the police department there in this town in Rhode Island, if I can remember the name. Do I still have it open here? No, I closed it. But here, let's try it again just for the hell of it. Every time I tried to ask for the public information officer, they put me through to a voicemail.
Falls Police Department.
Yeah.
For your safety,
okay.
All phone calls are recorded.
Okay.
If this is
We're
an emergency
going to the
or
operator.
Please wait while I transfer your call.
Okay.
Central Falls Police, Dispatcher Richards.
Hi, I would like the public information office or a communications director or somebody, please. I've called a number of times today, and I always get put to voicemail.
Sure. I mean, unfortunately, I can't guarantee that everyone's in. If you leave him a good voice message and a phone number, he checks his messages, he can get back to you.
Okay, well, can you just tell me why this officer who drove into a crowd of protesters is not under arrest yet?
Ma'am, I'm not allowed to give that information. I'm dispatch. This is emergency dispatch. The person you need to talk to, so I'm trying to transfer you to.
Okay,
so
please do.
Give me 1 second, I'll transfer you.
Thank you very much. Yes, Central Falls, Rhode Island. You know, if you want the number of the police department there, it's 401-727-7411. I'm going to get the voicemail again. Let's see.
You've reached the office of Major Craig Horton.
Major Craig Horton, this is a new guy.
Thank you.
You may start your message now. Press 0 to return to the attendant.
Hi, Major Horton. My name is Nicole Sandler. I am a radio host, a journalist of sorts, and I'm trying to understand why a corrections officer at the Wyatt Corrections Facility drove his truck into a group of peaceful protesters and was not arrested. I've been trying all day to get an answer from your police department and have not gotten a return phone call and can't get a live person on the phone. I would appreciate a call back. My number is 954-889-6410. Again, this so-called officer should be in prison. He tried to run over a group of peaceful protesters with a pickup truck. That's assault with the intention of killing or something like that, isn't it? Please do your job. Thank you. Have a nice day. So there's that. All right. I said if we had time, I would end the show with a song. We opened up, I said, you know, music is another great diversion. You know, comedy works because a laugh is always good to have. But sometimes songs, you know, say what you want to say. Now, I don't play music on this show often because I get copyright violated on YouTube. And, you know, they block my stuff worldwide. But I figured if I played an alternate version of a song, one that is not the commercial version, maybe I won't get copyright flagged on it. So we'll see. Back in 1999, one of my favorite albums of all time came out. In fact, if you look on my wall, if you're watching on YouTube, hold on. I have a bunch of gold records on the wall behind me, and I have one from a band called New Radicals. And it was a very short-lived band. The New Radicals only put out one album. It was called Maybe You've Been Brainwashed Too. And the guy behind it is this guy named Greg Alexander, who really did everything. He played, he had a few people helping him on the record, but he played all the instruments, wrote all the songs, did all the singing. He's one of those brilliant kind of people. And he wrote this song that was a hit in 1999 that should have been my anthem. And Greg Alexander came into my radio studio at the time I was doing music radio and performed it live for us. And I want to leave you today with that song, the live version of that song. Because the song is called You Get What You Give. And I hope you will listen to the lyrics. And you won't recognize this version of it. It's a bit different. But go out and listen to the original from New Radicals. You Get What You Give. I leave you with these words of wisdom. And my wish for you to have a great weekend and that, you know, we all get what we give. What you put out there is what you get back. So put out some goodness into the world, okay? Have a great weekend, everyone. I will see you back here on Tuesday. Until then, keep the faith, baby. Here's Greg Alexander. You get what you give.
Two, two. Wake up, kids, we got the dreamer's disease. Age 14, they got you down on your knees. So polite, we're busy still saying please. Frenemies, when you're down, it's your friend. Every night, smash your Mercedes-Benz. First we run, and then we laugh till we cry. But when the night is falling, you cannot find the light. You feel your dreams are dying. Hold tight. You got the music in you. Don't let go. You got the music in you. One dance left. This world is gonna pull through. Don't give up. You got a reason to live. Can't forget. We only get what we give. Oh, oh, I'm coming home, baby. Your time. You hear me now. 4 a.m. We ran a miracle mile. We're flat broke, but then we did it in style. The bad rich. Crash.